0.GX 24,000s in them, so the output of the transmitter was slightly less than 24 kilowatts. The actual ERP on those antennas was about 225 kilowatts.
Okay. How much noise energy do you think would be produced at 220 to 221 megahertz? Just a rough guess. Or something located in the same building.
It would be a real pain because don't forget Channel 13 is at, 213. Not an even harmonic at 220, but boy, oh boy, if you've got a receiver there, it's going to squash its front end.
Oh, I know that. And the guy who was the engineer that owned the company that put the equipment up there, I said, as soon as you put the equipment up there, it's not going to work. And they could hear the equipment out by Nassau or Queens Board Alarm, but they couldn't talk back into it. And I says, see what you get for not listening?
Well, let me tell you about the World Trade Center. Besides the areas that you really shouldn't stand for more than 2 or 3 minutes, I had my repeater, which is 447-200 up there, and in order to be able to hear anything, I had to put the receiver down on 108th floor, or at least the receiver's antenna down on 108th floor. You put an antenna up at the top, you can't hear nothing, and I mean nothing.
Doesn't surprise me at all. Over to you, Dick. What do you think?
Oh, these islands are very difficult requirements. That's a tough one. Frank, WB2BXO, go right ahead with your question or comment. You got it, Frank.
Yeah, very good. I've noticed here in Northeast Philadelphia that at one point I was able to get most of the major over-the-air channels, HD channels, with a cheap portable set and the modern equivalent of rabbit ears. And now, with a cheap portable set, or even a good HD set, and one of these cheap HD antennas, I guess one of these planar flat things, I can only consistently get one channel, that is Channel 7 branded, and maybe some of the sub-channels. Has the antenna patterns changed down here in Philadelphia also with the local stations, just as it has in New York? Eric, do you know what's happening in this area? Go ahead.
Let me get a clarification on this one, Frank. Are you talking about the over-the-air broadcast channel from the Philadelphia area, or are you talking about reception from the New York City area? Back to you, Frank. Wait for the beep.
I'm not hearing any beep here through EchoLink. No, I'm sorry. I should have clarified, realizing that you guys are on Long Island. I'm talking about the over-the-air channels, and I misspoke. I meant Philadelphia Channel 6. I was thinking of the ABC affiliate, not New York Channel 7, so that's why I confused you also. I'm talking about the Philadelphia local channels. Go ahead.
Okay. If you understood that question, you've got it, Eric.
How far away are you from Philadelphia?
I'm in Northeast Philadelphia. I know I have to fix that. I know the little pin on the QRZ map is not correct. I'm right across the street from the PNE, Philadelphia Northeast Airport, if that helps, if you want to look me up on Google. Go ahead.
Is it the equivalent of the Empire State Building in Philadelphia, Eric? KE2EJ, KE2IW?
There's a couple of different transmitter sites in Philadelphia. There's been some antenna changes and a few other things. I'm not really all that familiar with it. I know about it. I know we got 8YY here, what the bands are right. But there's been some changes down there. As far as him not being able to get what he used to get, I could ask somebody and find out. But I don't think things have changed that much, that it's just changed the ability to pick them up.
Yeah, I'd be very curious to know whether the problem is on my end, where I'm just using a cruddy or broken antenna, or whether, in fact, over-the-air coverage in Northeast Philadelphia is just, in technical terms, stinko. Go ahead.
No, I'll be quite honest. I would look at your end, because things haven't changed. They will change, but they haven't really changed that much yet. I know there was some antenna changes and a few things like that, but they're still coming from the same place. They're still running the same power. There's also one or two of the stations showing a shift. but I'm not absolutely sure about it. I'm just talking off the top of my head what I barely remember, but come back next week and I'll probably give you a better answer.
Okay, I will try to be on next week. Thanks a lot, Eric. WB2BXO in Northeast Philadelphia.
Okay, I hope we haven't put Paul to sleep. WS2N with our space report. What's NASA and all those other guys been doing this week, and what are they about to do, Paul? WS2N, space report number 260 of the series, K2RIW. You got it, Paul.
Very good. WS2N for the space report. Anyway, anything about channel 43.3 called Comet. You have all the old science fiction shows on that. I don't know where that's coming from, but that's in and out. Maybe Eric knows.
Bridgeport. Yeah, I get channel 43-3 Comet a little bit intermittently. Joe, did you say that's coming from Bridgeport? It's not coming from New York City? W2RYY, go ahead.
Yeah, it's RF-42. It's coming from Bridgeport. It's WSAH. 43-2 or 3 is their Comet channel. But the main channel is like a religious channel. But yeah, it's coming from Bridgeport.
Okay, I'll have to turn my antenna.
Oh, ho. No wonder I was in trouble with that one. Go ahead, Paul.
Like you, Dick, I need a rotator. Okay, now I know why that's in and out. Thanks, Joe. Soyuz crewed vehicle went up on Friday for three more people to the International Space Station. And that successfully docked. They only do like four revolutions of the Earth now. Instead of 2 days to get there, it's only 6 hours to dock with the space station. And then they're able to start. They've done that a number of times. Once in a while, they don't do that. But the goal is to have that on every launch, and once we start launching from Cape Canaveral again, from Florida, same thing with the Boeing CST-100 Dragon crewed vehicle from SpaceX. Yeah, they joined the other three astronauts on board. Peggy Woodson is still on board. The Russian commander, he's still there. As well as Jack Fisher, who dropped it.
Paul, what changed to allow them to dock in 6 hours instead of 2 days? How did they do that?
Yeah, they require a zero window. Normally they have a window before or after the mission. If they're directly right overhead, you know, I mean, when I say the overhead, the space station as it's going directly overhead, they're perfect planes. Then they can do it. Sometimes that plane that can't be reached or can't match proper launching time, whatever they want to do, and then they'll go with the 2 days flight. So that's the ultimate goal. Naturally, nobody wants to sit on that small Soyuz spacecraft for 2 days before they dock. Also, equipment. Sometimes they'll do upgrades to the Soyuz. They'll put a new radar system or communication system. Don't trust it yet. So what they'll do is they'll go by the old system, give themselves a little time. Different thrusters they've tried, tried different things. You know, over but only the last couple of years now that they've been orbit docking profiles back to the.
Very fine, Paul. You probably have quite a bit more on space report. Is that true? Go ahead.
Oh sure. Now, out of the three that went up. One guy is naturally from Russia. There's always one Russian because they have to command that Soyuz spacecraft. And then the other fellow was Paolo Nespoli. He's been up previous times. He's no kid. He's 60 years old, 6'0". But he's the only ham that, out of the three. Usually two or three people are hams going up. So, well, his eye is Z0, J-P-A, so he'll be up there, and naturally when he uses the radio, he'll be using the NASA side instead of the Russian side. He's really a NASA astronaut from ESA, European Space Agency, so they'll be using the radio in the Columbia module, make contacts with schools, you know, across our country anyway. Russians, they still do it as well. Have a radio in their module. Let me drop it. So they're joining the commander. It's up there. He's the ham, RN3FI. And then, of course, Peggy Whitson, she's been up there since, like, last November. She's not going to be going now for about another month. So she's almost making a year. Not quite, but close. She'll be coming down probably in about a month or so. I think beginning of September, she'll be coming back down with K2FSH, that's Jack Fisher. But the crew now is going to be six people come back down. So within 10 days, they'll be sending another crew up with three people. So that will be our space station with six people on board. And eventually, we're going to start building another space station. This time, it will be around the moon. There's confirmation of doing something like this. But they call it the Deep Space Gateway. Now Lockheed Martin, it looks like they're made there anyway. They're probably going to be the ones chosen. And they have ideas already how to do it. They're designed and probably even the same module that space shuttle used to bring up in the back of the cargo bay. Well, the multi-purpose module. Different names, Leonardo, and then this is another one that they want to use. Leonardo is one of the ones they would bring it up in the back of the cargo bay. They would berth it to the space station, open the door, unload everything, put other stuff back in. This thing would hold like, 15,000-20,000 pounds of stuff. They put it back in, they would unberth it with a robotic arm, they would put it back in the back of the cargo bay and bring it back and land on land, take everything out, got the shuttle back to the hangar. But this multi-purpose unit, there were three of them, they would take turns bringing them up the space station over the years. But at the end of the space shuttle system, 2011, they decided to take one of these modules and rebuild it for a permanent structure for the space station. One named Leonardo redid everything, refurbished it, and on one of the last flights, they attached it permanently to the International Space Station. Now they have one module that they actually use for storage, food, water, things like that. So now they plan on, NASA plans on building this gateway, eventually probably two of these modules. Will eventually be attached in orbit around the moon. You can send a crew out for up to 42 days, bring them back. It's not going to be permanently manned, so these modules have to be autonomous, self-sufficient themselves in orbit with nobody there. So, you'll have an abandoned manned space station for a month or two. And eventually another crew would go back. NASA's really believing probably will go ahead and do. That will give them plenty of practice to eventually have a similar module or similar setup eventually in orbit around Mars. So that's what they're up to. Let me drop it. A couple of other topics. I probably have about nine things, but we don't have enough time for that. Dream Chaser, we talked about last week, many other weeks, that's being built by Sierra Nevada Corporation. And presently, right now, they're testing it out in California. They're pulling it around on the runway, letting it loose, go by itself. Computers are operating. Now the Dream Chaser is not going to be manned, not yet anyway, but it's a cargo vehicle. They have plans on actually creating a system where you can put astronauts on board. Now, they have just signed a company, Sierra Nevada Corporation, that's building Dream Chaser. signed up with ULA, United Launch Alliance. ULA is it's really two corporations, Boeing and Lockheed Martin. They're the ones that launched the Atlas V rocket. Dream Chaser will now be officially launched by the Atlas. You know, over the years, I was pretty sure it was going to go that way. But which configuration, I wasn't too sure. They're going to go with the Atlas V rocket, which is your standard at the time anyway, Russian engine, RS-180. It's actually one engine with two thrusts coming out, two combustion chambers. So the one engine, which is going to produce some up to 900,000 pounds of thrust, but then they're going to have five boosters attached to it. Two of those boosters is going to be around 350,000 pounds of thrust. So you're going to wind up with a couple of million pounds of thrust to get this Dream Chaser off the ground. And on top of that, they're going to have it. It's a configuration called the 552 configuration. Originally, they were thinking about a 442, 452. First number, 5, that means the diameter of the bearing that's going to protect the Dream Chaser is going to be 5 meters in diameter. And then the second 5 in that group of numbers, 552, the second number stands for how many boosters they're going to attach to the rocket. Atlas could go up with one booster, two booster, and even 5, in this case it's 5. And then the 2, in that grouping of numbers, 552, stands for how many rocket engines are going to be on the second stage. It's always been a 1. It's always been some, you know, designation with the last number as a 1. This time it's going to be 2. It'll be running as 2 RL-10 engines. RL-10 engines has been around for decades, and they've upgraded them over the years. Built by Aerojet Rocketdyne, and going to actually use 2. In total, this whole setup could lift around 40,000 pounds, so that's a payload, which would include the orbiter itself, the Dream Chaser, and whatever weight the Dream Chaser will bring to the International Space Station. In this case, they could bring up to 12,000 pounds, which is over twice the amount of weight that the Russians will bring up in the cargo version, the Progress drop. I have other topics, but I'm looking at the time. If you have any questions on this, we'll do it. You know, there's a James Webb Space Telescope thing. We talked about the refrigeration. I got a whole bunch of stuff on that. Last week we were wondering what the lowest temperatures were, and I said I would find it, and I did. Last week I said they were going to go below 7 degrees Kelvin, Dick, and turns out I was close to 6.2. They're going to bring the back their head down to 6.2 Kelvin. Any questions, you or anybody else? This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Back to you, Dick.
With nobody with any questions right now, I'd like to hear more about James Webb. What is the temperature that you're getting on the backside of those 5 Earth shields, the Mylar Earth shields? I'm going to guess it's some number like 15 degrees Kelvin, I guess on my part. And then by the refrigeration system, bringing that down to 6 1/2 degrees Kelvin, if I understand correctly. And is that cooler, mechanical cooler, like a refrigerator that's got a rotary scroll or a real piston to it? So it's a real mechanical cooler with a piston, real compression taking place. It's a little bit worrisome about what is the anticipated life of that thing. When something has to rotate and run a piston, so to speak, in order to do the cooling, theory is only going to have a certain number of hours of operation before potentially it has some form of failure. So tell me about James Webb and temperature, Eric. Joe. Here you go, Paul. WS2M, Space Report number 260, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm up to 261 here, off by one. But whatever, the system that they're using, there's no freon involved. Their refrigeration is going to be helium. And they have, the cooler is going to be located on the one side of the web. And they're going to have this, I would call it piping. It's really two very fine tubing. They call it a supply return line in the articles I found. Refrigeration is usually called the discharge and suction line, but they're not using those terms. It's going to be pushing helium through one micrometer of diameter on a tube, and then there's twice that diameter for the return. Where it actually goes from the, I call it the high side to the low side, be right at the junction head itself. So the unit is on the warm side of James Webb, and then many meters away, the piping is eventually going to go through and go directly to the head detector, goldish block of that's going to get very cold down to 6.2 degrees. Now, the reason they have this, this whole setup, James Webb, we know, is an infrared space telescope. Yeah, it's going to have some visible light capability. It's going to be on a reddish side on sort of visible light. Then the microns, they go by wavelengths. They don't go up frequency. So the wavelength for three of the detectors, there's going to be four main detectors on board, in all infrared. Three of them go roughly between 0.6 and 5 microns. I have no problem with that. They said that they could even operate up to 37 degrees Kelvin, so they wouldn't even need this refrigeration system that they're installing for that. But there's another wavelength group that's wavelength is actually higher, so it's 5 to 28 microns. And that's what they need this extreme cold temperature for. So the longer the wavelength, colder this, the detectors really have to be. So there's four detectors. Three of them, they kind of don't need that. I mean, they're going to utilize that anyway, but they really need it on the fourth one. They call that the MIRI detector, the mid-infrared instrument detector. So that's, call it an arsenic doped silicon detector. I'm trying to figure out if that was similar to gallium arsenide, field effect transistor, something I would be familiar with the ham radio, but apparently it's an arsenic doped silicon, call it SIAS. For their abbreviation. So that's what they're using, and they got to get it below 7 degrees Kelvin. The refrigeration device looks like they're probably about 18 inches long, two of them. They oppose one another. And apparently there's some kind of piston system going back and forth at only two hertz per second. The reason they like these things is that they're moving so slow relative to some kind of a very quick compressor type of system, because they don't want any movement or very little movement at all to this Webb Space Telescope. It's going to be pointing at stars or looking for the Big Bang or something. It doesn't want to move. The reason they have these two opposing pistons, the picture I have shows it attached to, it's in the central body of the telescope. The reason they have it is, if one's moving, the other one's going the other way, it's going to cut back on any kind of movement. It's going to cancel the movement out. Now, it's a cascade type of system. There's also two more of these pistons, and one is going to be cooling the, what I call the discharge, or so-called condenser. I really don't know. It's not really a real refrigeration system from what I'm seeing. With a liquid high side and a TX valve, a thermostatic expansion valve in between. It's a pretty exotic setup. Let me drop it. It's been around, they said, for 20 years. years, 25 years, and only, you know, in the last 10 years that they've developed this type of setup. And it's some kind of pulse tube. No, what do they call it? Can't think of the name. It'll come to me. Some kind of a pulse tubing setup. But the tube is really not little tiny tubes. It's these big pistons. The diameter of these pistons look like they're about 5 or 6 inches in diameter. All going to be helium. And both cascade systems, one's going to be cooler than the other system. Both systems are both going to use helium. So that's what I know about it, Dick. Back to you. This is WS2S. Question?
Joe, recognize the helium cooling refrigeration system, Paul. What is the temperature on the cold side at the detector? What's the temperature on the hot side? And why is it operating on the hot side of the shield as opposed to the cold side? So it's starting off at what temperature with the helium and bringing it down to what temperature? So how many degrees of cooling, and why is it starting off on the hot side? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, because any heat they're trying to get rid of, by the way, I don't have the numbers for the high side, 6.2 will be at the block where the detectors are. I guess there's some sort of fancy detectors. So naturally you're going to cooling from the detectors, and you want to get rid of it. You don't want to discharge this heat on the cold side of the on the telescope side. You want to get rid of the heat on the sun side. And by the way, the sun side temperature is like 180, 100. Naturally, the other side is it's minus 400 degrees, minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, getting down to eventually at the head 6.2, but the general temperature on the cold side is going to be around 30, 35 degrees Kelvin. Back to you there.
Yeah, here's my next question before I turn it over to Joe. The hydrogen cooling system brings it down to 6.2 Kelvin at the detector. If the hydrogen cooling system fails, you have nothing protecting you on the cold side other than the 5 heat shields. That's the fallback as I see it. What temperature do you have on the cold side of the 5 heat shields, assuming you have no refrigeration running? Over to you, Paul.
They expect the highest temperature to be 37 degrees on the cold side, which will be fine for these three, this total 4 detectors. In other words, if it wasn't for the fourth one, they wouldn't need the refrigeration system at all. They could run it just passively. It's good because if something ever goes wrong with this system, and eventually something will fail mechanically. Or, by the way, they show all these electronic boxes in one of the other pictures. There must be 4 or 5 of these boxes lined up, and then they're not tiny. I'm amazed at the size of some of this stuff. But so that's pretty much the way it's going to go. I'll look for further information, and they're going to keep it below. I think the highest temperature they expect is 37 degrees on the cold side. You've got gigantic sunshade, 5 layers in the heat away. Back to you.
Yeah, earlier you said minus 400 Fahrenheit, which turns out to be 33 Kelvin. So somewhere around 33 Kelvin, 37 Kelvin, without refrigeration is what you get on the cold side with just the shield, which is a hell of a lot hotter than the 6.2 Kelvin. But at least as a fallback, you still have a infrared telescope, not quite as high in performance. Is there any estimation as to even though this piston only has to operate 2 cycles per second, any estimation as to how long that's going to last, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, they're hoping between 5 and 10 years. So anything after that is gravy. Call it cryo cooler. That's the words they use for this thing. So it's outstanding. By the way, there's a website now you can go to where it's a webcam, and bring it up and you look at this door. And this door, I don't know, looks like it's about 10 feet in diameter. And inside this chamber is located in Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio, at the Glenn Research Center. And they put James Webb inside this thing. They brought the back. now the temperature, they showed a temperature, oh wait, correction, this, the work was being done, a lot of work being done in for some other project in Ohio, talking about Houston. They have this webcam in Houston where James Webb is located, and they're bringing the temperature down to, you know, they want to get it down to, you know, the 30 degree Kelvin range. Right now it's at, brought it up before, it was, oh, I don't know, I think it was 20 degrees Kelvin. They got it down pretty far. But you can bring this up on a regular basis. I mean, it's not much to look at. They have the outside temperature in Houston, you know, 90 degrees, 0.3, whatever it is. And then below that, they have the chamber temperature inside the air. Right now, it's going to be there, I guess, like a month or two. Back to you.
Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, wait for the beeps and go right ahead.
Okay, very good there, Dick.
Paul.
Paul, have they used a robotic system to be able to work on or repair this refrigeration system? Because I imagine this thing is going to have some sort of pressure inside this thing on one side. I understand how air conditioning in general, how it works. You got a high side, or, you know, higher pressure on one side than another side of a compressor. And then, of course, this thing is totally out in the vacuum of space. There's a lot of differential. Can they estimate how long this thing is going to last, number one? And number two, if something fractures, like a pipe fractures, and something happens, and all of a sudden you lose your coolant. It goes just bye-bye. Can they repair this thing by robotics? Have they tried to do that yet, to be able to repair anything that they might think that can go wrong? Because once this thing's up there, like you said, it's going to be a million miles up. We can't go up there to fix it, not astronauts. So how else are you going to do it without robotics?
Yeah, I don't even think you can bring the... I don't think you can bring a robotic system back. So even a robot would be one-way trip. And no, they haven't. There's no plans for fixing this. I mean, they do have a docking collar attached to it with the idea of, you know, like 10 years ago when they thought of putting this thing together, designing it, that let's put a docking collar on it. You never know. But at this time, no, there's nothing. If something goes wrong, it's with yourself. Now, the piping is extremely thin tubing. They have clamps every couple of inches, like special refrigeration clamps. They say if you look at the tubing itself, it looks like brake lines on your car. It's thin ID, but the OD is on a relative thick side, like looks like a brake line. So they have it attached, going up, I think they said around 10 meters away before it gets to the cooling location. Now they have a valve set up, because you know they don't want any kind of problems during launch. So there's some kind of automatic valves that are, I guess, solenoid valves of some sort that are closed. This way, nothing's getting near the head. You know, nothing's flowing, nothing's moving. Those valves won't be open until they get to L1 a million miles out. I guess back to there.
Is it Lagrange 1 or Lagrange 2 or 3? I'm not sure it's Lagrange 1, but that's a minor problem. I think you said 10 meters of tubing between the hot side and the cold side. And this tubing, it's only, I think you said, a micron in diameter, but it looks like brake line, which means it's probably got the multiple layers of insulation to it. To your knowledge, Paul, is there a change of state here? Is hydrogen doing the cryo cooling? Does the hydrogen get compressed and cooled to a liquid and then go to an expansion valve and become a gas? Or is it just a high and low pressure gas throughout the whole system? What's your guess on all of that, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
I don't think there's a change of state, but I can't say for sure. I've been looking up during the week something called pulse tube. It's a pulse tube system. And that's what they say about it. So naturally, you know, I go off on different websites. I can't find much on it. Now, one PDF file on it, one Wikipedia article. There's like nothing on this thing. So I'm sure there will be by the time it goes up. So I don't know if there's a change of state. I just don't think so. In a couple of little diagrams that I saw, I don't see any like that. I think it's just, you know, like thermodynamics, you know, you pump air into a tire, you know. You can push as much as you want, and you're going to feel the tire eventually get hot by hand. The other way around, if you take a tire, it's pressurized, you just let air out of it. It doesn't have to change to a, you know, from a liquid to a gas to have a cooling effect. I think that's what they're doing back here.
Yeah, good old PV equals NRT. Just changing pressure changes temperature. Compressor, I think you said it's 2 pulses per second. Is there a real crankshaft and a rotator? Yeah, a crankshaft. Is that a... are the pistons, the two opposing pistons, to make sure it's balanced and not make vibration? That sounds like it's operating off of a crankshaft. And what kind of an electric motor, I'm guessing, turns that pole? Is that a brushless DC motor, do you believe? WS2N, K2IW?
No, I have a picture, I'll send it to you. It's the two large pistons, and then above that, two smaller pistons. Cascade system. I mean, you could really do this whole system with one system, but they have the two pistons opposing one another to stop the vibration. They don't want any kind of vibration with a telescope. So they show one of the guys, one of the workers, standing there. You know, everybody's always in funny suits work on any of this stuff. They go into the area where this thing is. It's a big deal. They spend a lot of time getting ready to go in, like super sterilized people when they go in. And when they're in for a long time. You know, you don't go out for a cigarette break. Nobody smokes anymore. You don't go out for a coffee break. Back to you, Dick.
But what is physically moving those pistons, Paul? Is it a crankshaft powered by an electric motor? What is moving those big pistons and small pistons? Go ahead.
I can't see it. I'm looking at the picture. I just brought it up again. I can't see the motor. I can see the piston. And, I mean, maybe I could magnify this thing later. But, not seeing it. But, yeah, I'm sure there's something doing that, of course. You know, I'm just seeing the outside of it, you know. It's like looking at the engine of a car. And if you didn't know there were four cylinders in there, you wouldn't know what you were looking at.
Is it possible that the pistons are really solenoid magnets, that they're pulsing magnets to move the pistons, and there's no real crankshaft? Is that possible, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I thought of that too, because there is a magnetic Joule Thompson type of system that I did find, but they didn't say that this had it. Yeah, that's possible.
And that piston is moving inside of a cylinder, and there must be piston rings. How are those piston rings being lubricated at temperatures like 2.6, no, what is it now? 6.2 degrees Kelvin, 6.2 Kelvin. How do you lubricate a piston ring at 2.6 Kelvins, Paul, without creating metal chips? Go ahead.
I think they're diaphragms. I think it's a sealed system. And this diaphragm or maybe bellow-like structure. Again, I can't see the inside, but I think it's that type of design. It's just like you have a control valve on big equipment. You know, you open and close these big valves, and you know, these could be massive valves, you know. Things that you know, a truck couldn't even pick up, but yet here's this little diaphragm thing sitting on top, which when pressurized pushes the piston rod down with no problem. I think it's a diaphragm type of system. I can't imagine this thing having a real piston going back and forth with a crankshaft, you know, connecting rods or anything. I'm not seeing it.
Okay, let's assume that it's a diaphragm, with or without bellows to that diaphragm. You're still flexing something that's eventually going to wear out. And what's supplying the mechanical motion to move that diaphragm, Paul? Got a guess? K2IW?
No, I mean, it could be a motor, and it could be like what you're saying. You still could have a magnetic, almost like a large solenoid thing
pushing the thing back and forth. But I don't know yet. I wouldn't be surprised if it was some kind of magnetic system like that. It'll all come out. Well, when I research it more, I've only been looking at this the last couple of days, so haven't come across it yet. I felt lucky to find this stuff. Show all the boxes laying out. You know, I mean, it looks like it would cover the length of my room here. You know, all these boxes are going to control this whole thing. I mean, you know, they got a lot riding on this thing. Thousands and millions of pieces, it looks like, between the compressor setup and all the electronics. Got to work, and I'm running out of time. Back to you, K2RIWWSUN.
Paul, is the launch date set for September of 2018? Is that approximately the launch date, or maybe October?
Yes, September of next year. I'll be looking forward. That will be launched from Kourou, French Guiana, on an Ariane 5 rocket. That's going to be pretty cool. That's a very reliable rocket. I think it's going to work. By the way, you want to know, earlier on, L2, Lagrange point 2, 1 million miles out, Sun, Earth, James Webb Space Telescope. Back to you.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Good stuff. You guys just heard TechNet number 1661. I did have the number wrong. And TechNet number 261. Sending through you all. Be kind to each other. Bye-bye, and see you next week, and we'll have even more information on James Webb. And I'm glad they added the docking ring to it, Paul. At least they have the capability of latching onto it. If some very genius of a guy like Elon Musk builds a robot that can go out to L2, WS2N, he's going to make a prediction for Elon Musk making a robot that will go to L2. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW. Bye-bye.
To him, or 10 years down the road, you're going to have Jeff Bezos. He'll be flying rockets on a regular basis, just like SpaceX. Maybe he'll do it too. He'll have that capability. Very large rockets. This thing building looks like, I mean, it's almost the same size of a Saturn V visually when I look at the diagram. And that's called the New Glenn. And that'll be liquid methane with liquid oxygen. Maybe he'll do it. 73 guys, will have a very good day, and we'll catch you next week. WSMN clear.
D2RW, WD2GXM.
Mr. GXO, start up your name and go right ahead.
It's Rich, WD2GXM. Surprised you can hear me from this part of the house. Did you go to the picnic?
Negative. I didn't get to the picnic. And tell me what I missed. Go ahead, Glenn.
I didn't get there either, but I was wondering if I went, if I was going to meet you in person. I was curious. Well, okay. Next time.
Maybe next time. Bye-bye for now, Brent.
EP2GXM clear.
Wonderful net.
Time is 12:00 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2L repeater.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Anyway, good morning from Manhattan. Looks like a beautiful day.
indeed who it is. Name you his wish. Did you forget? Romeo in the Charlie Hotel. If you forgot, I don't blame you. It's been a while.
No, Rich, I didn't forget. I'm not, not forgetful, although sometimes I do forget. But in this case, that's a name I remember. And, hope you had a good weekend. Today looks like one of those, pretty good summer days that we wish we had more of.
Yes, absolutely nicer. Nicer than winter with the snow. Had a problem here yesterday. I misjudged my insulin, and my sugar went down to 45. Patty called EMS, but by the time they got here, she gave me a lot of sugar mixed in water, so it burned it right up.
Well, sounds like you knew what to do. I was fortunate you first saved yourself a trip to the emergency room and lots of other good stuff, which is not so good unless you need to do it. So, sounds like you made a good, quick decision. And I guess you won't make that mistake again.
Yeah, hopefully not. You know what I refer to Patty as? My Clarence. My Clarence. If you ever saw the movie It's a Wonderful Life, with the angel who jumps into the water when, who was, I forget his name in the movie, but it was Peter Stewart, was that him? She's equivalent to that.
That's right. Angel's got to get its wings. Anyway, yeah, I've seen that movie more than once. Not at this time of the year.
All right, Peter. Are you in Manhattan? Because if you're by all the buildings, you're really coming in.
Well, I'm in traffic on the FDR moving very slowly, so lots of buildings to the west and, you know, just the river to the east, so I'm sure that helps. But every once in a while, we'll go under and know, a tunnel or an overpass, underpass, whatever. So, I'm sure it'll vary, but mostly it should be good.
Very good, Peter, and to you. All right. Like I say, the repeater has been dead. Nobody this morning. I had it on. I got up at 6.
Well, that's late for me. But, on the weekend, I don't like to be up before 6 anyway. But Monday morning, we're back in the routine. We, not much maritime traffic on the river this morning, but lots of red lights going south. Guess, people are still going to work. Anyway, Rich, I'm sure you miss it.
Yeah. Absolutely, Peter. You know, me and Patty are here all day. Her son goes to work. He, by trade, is an exterminator. But he leaves here about 7:30.
Very good, Rich. I got to take a cell call. I'll be back shortly.
Okay, Peter. KCKKX and Tulio, do what you have to do.
KKX, back.
Peter again, KC2X, and Tulio, I was in the bathroom washing my hands.
Hey, sir, am I seeing this thing in Scarsdale?
How about you, M2EO?
K2MIT.
Okay, somebody else was in there, but he said his call a little too quick. Oh, okay. I gotta take Sidner a couple of minutes, so I'm gonna be leaving here in about 3 minutes. Five minutes, did it? Yeah, something like that. One or the other. I just heard you on. And to the other station, come on in. This is N2MB.
N2MB from K2MIT. Sorry, I am a fast-talking New Yorker. Is that Jerry in the background? I couldn't quite hear the tail end of his transmission. Jeffrey here, Westchester County, driving down to the Bronx to go to school and teach. So, another hot day in the city.
Okay, Jeff. Well, it's not hot around here. I don't even think it's 70 degrees out this morning. It's a nice cool breeze coming through the window. My cat is sitting there listening to the birds. It's a good day to be a cat. Over to you, Rich, and 2MB.
Okay, Barry. And Jeffrey, very good. Hey, guys, you know what happened to me yesterday? I misjudged my insulin. So I went all the way down with sugar number. It should be between 80 and 140. It dropped down to 45. Patty called EMS, but in the meantime, she gave me a lot of sugar mixed in water, and it came up by the time they were here. So I walked out. Jeff, over to you.
Barry, I had the same problem. Do you have a continuous glucose monitor that can warn you when you're diving so you can prevent that from happening?
No, I never heard of such a thing. But I can tell. You know when your sugar's going low. And I tested it, and it was 45. I called Patty, and she came down. There was a package. I didn't know there was sugar down here. So she quickly mixed it up in water.
Don't mind me giving 30 years worth of advice. There's a gel. It's in a little tube, and it's the fastest way to give yourself, other than a shot of, I forgot the name of the medicine. It's essentially sugar in a syringe, a glucagon kit, that's it. But, yeah, I can tell when it's at 50 and 40. The nice thing about the continuous glucose monitor is hooked up to your pump, and it's constantly reading your interstitial blood glucose, and it'll tell you when you're below 70 and diving rapidly. And that gives you a lot more warning than when you get down to 50 and 40. If you're on a pump, there's lots insurance companies to provide you with a continuous glucose monitor under professional advice of a doctor, so it's covered by your insurance company if you have such. So I would look into it. It's changed my life.
All right, Jeff, the last thing that I want is an insulin pump. Don't want one. All right, look, everybody is different. Barry, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I won't be for long. I'll be out of here in 5 minutes. Richie, you used to talk about Jeremy going into the alarm business. I notice you don't mention it anymore. So is that history or what?
Yes, I think so. He's an exterminator. He likes doing the work. At least I think he does.
Okay. Because I notice all you talk about now is the exterminator business. You never mention the alarm business anymore. Okay, I gotta get out of here. I'm sorry, but I'll be back. I just have to take it to the train station, so you'll still be here. I'll be back in about a half an hour. N2MB.
3 N2MB. Nice to meet you.
All right, Bobby, we'll see you later. And Jeffrey, I just want to keep it simple. I take insulin. I used to take it from a vial. Now I use the insulin pen.
Now, whatever works for you, but what's nice about a pump, and it's not hard, and it's not painful, is that you get a continuous basal drip, and then you can bolus. And it's been proven scientifically to lower your, as long as you test every, right before breakfast, you or lunch or dinner, and you put in the for carbohydrates. It figures out how much insulin you're going to need.